Welcome to the Hip Hop Digest Show with your man, DJ King Killer.
Don't forget about your boy, Kurt G.
And of course, it's E Green. And I don't know what's been going on lately. It must be in the water. But we have another hip hop legend here on the show to talk with us today. That is Mr. Rocky Buchanan. What's up, bruh?
All good, E. How you doing, brothers?
What's good?
Good.
All right.
Yes, sir. So first off, dang, man. We talked to Curtis Blow. He throws your name out there. And next thing you know, here we are. One of the legends of hip hop. Tell us about the Universal Hip Hop Museum that's coming up.
Well, the Universal Hip Hop Museum is taking on, taking on a life of its own. We started this project 3 years ago as a real estate development project here in New York City with myself, Curtis Blow, Africa Bambaataa, Grandmaster Melly Mel, Grand Wizard Theodore, and a couple other brothers who are all icons and pioneers from hip hop culture. And, when we first started, we tried to develop a building in partnership with a real estate developer by the name of Young Wu, who was trying to purchase this huge, facility called the Kingsbridge Armory, which is the world's largest armory in the West Bronx. And the city gave the building to somebody else named Mark Messier. You may know that guy. Used to play with the New York Rangers. And they're trying to convert that place in the Bronx into the largest ice skating palace. I can't figure that one out to save my life. Now. Ice skating over hip hop. But that's what they did. So when we lost that bid, we had to retool and rethink, how do we keep this project alive without losing momentum? And we always thought that we wanted to give the world access to hip hop culture. So we came up with a virtual museum platform that we're actually in design and development of right now and hope to launch by August of this year. We still have our, focus on building a brick and mortar in the South Bronx, but that project won't get started until 2017, and the building probably won't open until 2018. So, the Universal Hip Hop Museum, in my opinion, is the most important project that a lot of people still don't know about in hip hop.
No doubt. So we were talking about that, about a week ago whenever we were talking. It's still amazing how all these, hip hop is one of the youngest genres of music out there, but it has made such an impact that it just seems so ridiculous that it has taken all this time to get some kind of acknowledgement, like real acknowledgement for the genre itself.
Yeah, well, listen, like you said, rock and roll and jazz and, some of the other genres have been around a lot longer. But hip hop is maturing now. It's over 40 years old, so it's not that young, but, in a very short period of time, it has basically impacted the entire world. So it has gone from just being, what people thought would be a fad back, when it first started, to becoming the world's most popular art form. You can't go anywhere in the world without being influenced by hip hop in some sort of fashion.
No doubt. So the obvious question that I've got to put out here is, you mentioned a lot of the legends. Are there any current celebrity rap stars, and I'm using my words carefully, involved?
Not yet. We're reaching out to people. We have an amazing team here in New York City and Philadelphia and on the West Coast and in South Africa and in Asia. But our focus was really, it's like building a house. You have to have the icons and the founders involved first. And then, as you, build your frame for your house, then you can start adding in the furniture and bringing in, the cats from the 90s and then the cats from, today's era.
Okay.
So the focus has not been to, bring in any of the young cats yet. We want to make sure that we had a strong foundation of real solid people who, from the culture, who support the project And we have that. You know, we got Ice-T, we got KRS-One, we got Crazy Bone from Bone Thugs and Harmony, we got Q-Tip on board, we got Chuck D and Dougie Fresh and DMC and Pepper from Salt-N-Pepa, Paradise Great, who was in the group X-Clan. He's our chief curator. You know, so we got a lot of important icons from hip-hop culture. And of course, we got my guy Curtis Blow. Can't forget about him.
Of course.
You know, and, you know, all these people together are, you know, coming together, which is an amazing thing because, you know, when you think of hip-hop, you know it's supposed to be about, you know, peace, unity, love, and having fun. But, you know, for some reason, you know, the unity has not always been there, you know. So having a museum to bring everybody together, galvanizing the entire hip hop community is starting to happen now because people realize, hey man, you know, we need a museum to make sure that the history of hip hop is properly documented and preserved and protected. You know, because if we don't have a museum, then what happens is you leave it up to the universities and the Smithsonian and other people to document the history of hip hop who have no clue on what hip hop is.
Right. And I know King Killer is probably going to talk to you more about the, you know, the musical side of it, but I'm trying to get these questions about the Universal Hip Hop Museum. It's like, what was I going to ask you? Damn, I lost my train of thought that quickly because I'm like tripping right now that this has actually happened. But as far as the virtual part of it, is it up and running yet?
It's not up and running yet. You know, we have a Kickstarter campaign. We need to raise about $75,000 to finish the design and the development. We teamed up with a company called Framestore. I don't know how much you guys know about virtual reality technology, but if you're paying attention to, you know, some of the commercials on TV these days, you know, as, I don't know if you guys seen the LeBron James commercial with, you know, with Public Enemy in the background.
Have you seen
that one?
Yeah.
Well, they're promoting, Samsung is promoting what's called Samsung VR Gear, which is their virtual reality headset.
Right.
And everybody is putting a lot of money into virtual reality. This is going to be like the next big thing. So we teamed up with a digital special effects company called Framestore here in New York City. They're the top VR production studio in the world. They produced the movie Age of Ultron, The Martian, Guardians of the Galaxy.
Okay.
And when we teamed up with them and told them about our project, one of the directors at that time, his name was Mike Woods. He basically, you know, thought the project was amazing. You know, a museum for hip hop, and we want to use virtual reality technology to retell some of the, you know, stories of hip hop's glorious past using virtual reality technology. He's like, how can I get down?
Wow.
And basically, you know, we partnered with them and we created what's called the Curtis Blow VR experience designed for Google Cardboard. Google has a low-cost virtual reality viewfinder that is made out of cardboard. You won't believe it.
I'm still waiting for mine. I ordered one for free, actually, and I'm still waiting for it. So I had heard about that.
Yep. So, you know, when you get it, you know, you got to, you use your phone, download the Curtis Blow VR app. You put your phone inside the Google Cardboard, and you're going to be in the studio with Curtis Blow, where he recorded If I Ruled the World, and where Dougie Fresh recorded the show, and where Curtis Blow recorded a lot of the Fat Boys' first records.
Wow, it's incredible. What studio was that exactly?
It's Ralston Recording Studio. It's one of the iconic studios where a lot of the golden era songs from hip hop was recorded at. You know, nowadays you don't need a recording studio to make records. A lot of these cats just do it in their house now. But Ralston is still standing. The studio is still there. So you get to go right into the studio with Curtis Blow. And when you put on, you know, your Google Cardboard and you're looking at it, It makes you feel like you're standing in the studio with Curtis Blow. It's going to bug you out.
Well, that's the first thing I'm going to look at when I get him. Believe it.
Yep. And we, you know, last summer we were, you know, showing, you know, basically demonstrating it to a lot of people out, you know, in, you know, around New York City and different places around the country. And everybody we showed it to was like, they started freaking out. They're like, what the hell? You know, because no one really had seen what virtual reality is until they saw the Curtis Blow thing. Wow. And it bugged them out. They couldn't believe that they felt like they were standing in the studio. They're like, how do I feel like I'm standing in the studio with Curtis Blow? This is bugging me out. You know, so, so, you know, that's what our virtual reality museum is going to be, you know, known for, producing those kind of experiences. Because we want to be able to take cats from, you know, who have never lived or, you know, experienced, you know, the real hip hop. We can put them back in time and let them see what it was really about.
No doubt. And I have one more comment on that before we move into your history. We were very, very happy when VH1 and Fab Five came out with the whole, you know, hip hop honors. But the thing about it was, we were skeptical. All three of us, we were skeptical from the beginning. We were like, man, at some point, they're just going to start, as King Killer always says, shoehorning people in there. And it was cool. And as soon as they did that tribute to the South, we haven't seen one since. Do you know anything about that? What I'm talking about, the VH1 honors that was on for a few years back?
No. It's funny that you're talking about this because me and Curtis Blow, we were talking to Fab Five Freddy just yesterday. Mm-hmm. And Fab Five Freddy was one of the producers for that show. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the reason why we were on the phone with him is because we got a deal for the museum to produce our own award show called the Universal Hip Hop Honors, which will be... done next year. This time next year will be our first show, award show. So we, wow. You know, we want to speak to Freddie to see on the creative side, you know, what he thought about, you know, our kind of like concept for an award show in comparison to what he was working on. And we asked him, you know, what happened? And what happened was, you know, they were trying to reach out to some of the new cats to pay homage to some of the, you know, golden era cats. And they couldn't find artists that could actually rap like some of the cats back in the day.
I knew it.
Wow. They couldn't karaoke it? Oh, my goodness.
They couldn't do it.
King Killer's been saying that for years, that those cats just don't have the chops to be able to do what they did back in the day.
And me and Curtis was like, wow, are you kidding us? And they like, no, man. You know, it was funny. He gave us an example and he said, if you remember when they honored Big Daddy Kane and they had T.I. and I forget who the other two guys were. And then Big Daddy came out there and just tore it down. But they said they had the hardest time in rehearsals with T.I. just trying to do his verse.
Mm. That's a bad look anyway, though, to have T.I. I could 2020, hindsight is 2020, but I wouldn't have used T.I. to be Big Daddy Kane, so to speak. You know, they have a totally, not that T.I. shouldn't have been able to do it for that honor, but it's like, that's, I don't know if that was a good look.
Yep. And you know, so, and then because, you know, MTV and VH1 got away from playing music videos, a lot of the, you know, artists that they tried to get were no longer indebted to MTV. So they're like, yeah, why do I got to do this show for MTV? I'm not doing this. They're not even playing my video, you know. Wow. You know, so they ran into that kind of difficulties.
So it became about me and not the music, not the genre. It's crazy.
Yeah, we also thought over here on the show that those guys, they rushed it too fast. They like sped through the 80s too quick. They like tried to put a whole bunch of guys in too fast instead of like putting in like one or two guys a year. Instead of trying to rush in like four or five people.
And he told us, you know, they had all these different battles at VH1 and MTV inside the offices, because it became more about ratings than it was about producing a show about the culture.
Yeah.
Ratings always wins out when you're talking about TV.
Right. Well, so let's get into your history, sir. Talk about what was it about hip hop? I mean, obviously you were up there in the Bronx and the whole nine, but what was it that just pulled you into the genre?
Well, I've been around with hip hop even before hip hop was hip hop. You know, I don't want to give away my age, but you know, my cousin, he was one of the early influences of hip hop. His name was Pete DJ Jones.
Oh wow!
Wow, that's your cousin.
Yep, that's my cousin, and he was the top mobile DJ in New York City. You know, during the heydays of the disco era, he wasn't a disco DJ. Because he played a lot of funk and he played a lot of soul and other kind of stuff. You know, he would play Donna Summers when people wanted to hear Donna Summers, but that wasn't really his main thing. His main thing was playing the funk, you know, the Bar K's, James Brown, you know, Parliament, Sly and the Family Stones, Al Green, you know, all those kind of songs. And He became my mentor, you know, and I used to travel around with him when I was like 15 years old and not even supposed to be in a nightclub. So, you know, I would just sit behind him and watch and, you know, watch the people dancing all night long. And I just became a music junkie, you know, and, you know, just watching him and, you know, going home and then listening to. You know, at that time, we only had one radio station. Well, we had an AM station and an FM station. We had WBLS and WWRL. And, you know, listening to those radio stations and then hearing my cousin's name, you know, playing at this club or that nightclub every weekend. And I was like, that's my cousin, you know. So I just wanted to kind of like be like him and be like Frankie Crocker. And I just got into music at a very young age. And then, you know, when we made the transition from the disco era to, you know, start, you know, hearing, you know, playing, you know, just the breakbeats, you know, the short loops of the records, it became, you know, a different type of experience. And then I got my break, you know, at the age of, I think I was maybe 16 or 17, DJing in the first club that I played at, which was the Stardust Ballroom. And, you know, just seeing the lines of people trying to get into the club. And here I am, 16, 17 year old, spinning records. And, you know, people twice my age dancing to my music. You know, so it became a pretty amazing experience for me. And then, you know, as people from my neighborhood would come to the club, they were like, you know, why don't you bring your music outside? You know, so, you know, we would go play in the nightclub, you know, at the Stardust Ballroom, pack up at 4 o'clock in the morning, go home, wake up about 12, 1 o'clock, go to the park on, you know, on a Sunday and plug up, you know, about 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon, and then finish playing on a Sunday night out in the park about 11, 12 o'clock or when the guns went off and chased everybody out the park, you know. So that's what it was for me, you know. It was just, you know, watching one of the greatest, and then taking up that experience and doing it on my own. So, you know, I came from the Northeast Bronx. I'm not, you know, one of the guys from the South Bronx like Kool Herc and Bambaataa, but I know those guys, and they knew me, and we all had our own crews. And it was just a unique experience to be in New York City back in that time during the early 70s, because the music was just phenomenal. You know, playing, you know, Earth, Wind & Fire, or playing, you know, the Blackbirds, or playing Donald Byrd, or playing, you know, Trouble Funk and all those kind of songs, and being able to mix them and cut them. And not have to worry about anything, because you could play all different types of music, and that's what was the beauty of hip hop. You played the bongo rock, you played the Dennis Coffey, the Scorpio, the the King Ericssons, you know, all these different records. They didn't even sound alike. So, you know, it was a much different type of experience back then than it is now, because now all the music sounds alike and there's no diversity in the music.
Mm. Actually, so. You got to hear those Richard Long systems up close and at an early age, huh?
Early age, brother. Early age.
Wow, that's incredible. Rocky, I want to talk about a little bit of the history, your history, Strong City Records.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite records of all time, Cracked Out by Masters of Ceremony. Can you tell us about Strong City Records? Any notes on that particular recording?
Yes, yeah, so very interesting. So I actually had another record company called MLO, which stands for Music Lovers of the World. And I started that record company with a good friend of mine. His name is Milton LaCroix. He's into boxing now. But we produced the Masters of Ceremony's first record was called Crime, and it was on MLO.
I got that record.
Right? And that record was produced by Teddy Riley.
Wow.
If you look at the credits, you'll see T. Riley. That's Teddy Riley. That's
yep.
his very first record
yep.
as a producer.
Wow.
This guy here is pulled out the vinyl to that record right there. You talking about?
yep. And Teddy Riley, I found Teddy with Milton at the Apollo. He was not even 15 years old, playing keyboards like you would not believe, and we were like, "Who the hell is this kid playing the piano like that?" And, you know, we went, you know, on stage and asked him, said, "Yo, man, you play the crap out of that fucking piano." You know, and he was like, "Yeah, man, you know, this is what I do, man. I make," and he was like 15. We like, "Yo, man, we got to put you in the studio and make some records, man." So we put him in the studio. We had these cats, Grand Puba Maxwell and Doctor Who and Shabazz, and they were from New Rochelle, and we took them in the studio. They'd never been in the studio. And we like, yo, let's go ahead and make a record. And we went in the studio and we didn't know what the hell we were doing. And, you know, Teddy just said, let's do this and let's do that. And out came Crime. And then after that, I wanted to do something different with the group. And me and Milton kind of like went our separate ways. And I teamed up with Jazzy J. He had a studio in the Bronx. And I had saw him at a nightclub. And I was like, yo, Jazzy, you know, I want to do a label. I know that you're not happy with Def Jam. He was actually one of the three owners of Def Jam. Nobody knows that about Jazzy J. It was Jazzy J, Rick Rubin, and Russell Simmons. And Jazzy recorded the first record for Def Jam, which was It's Yours with Tila Rock.
Yes.
Wow. And I have that record, original.
And it wasn't on the Def Jam label, it was on Party Time, but that was actually Def Jam's first record. Wow. And then he recorded a record with Russell Simmons. And that was the second record on Def Jam before LL did I Need a Beat.
That was a record called Def Jam, wasn't it? I got that record. Yes.
The Def Jam, yep.
And you're talking to real dudes here, man. We
yep.
It goes back.
I see. And basically, they cut Jazzy out. Russell and Rick cut Jazzy out. And he was pissed off, and he's like, you know, I hate these guys, blah, 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 you know, whatever, whatever, whatever. But I was like, yo, forget those guys. Let's do our own record company. And that's how Strong City was formed, you know. And our first record was Cracked Out, which was, Maxwell's, real big intro into, you know, the hip-hop scene during the golden era. And we took that song. It was recorded in Jazzy's studio. And all those, you know, cracked out, all that stuff was done by edits. We had to edit, splice the tape, and made all those different edits to create that sound on Cracked Out.
Yeah, that's an incredible record. It's one of my favorites. So let me ask you, now is the busy now between Strong City and UNI? I know was Busy Bee was on that label. Was that still a part of Strong City or?
Yep. So one of my biggest mistakes. So, you know, I should have stayed independent instead of going with MCA. It was a terrible mistake for me, but you live and you learn. So, you know, when we had Strong City and we were rolling with Masters of Ceremony, and we had a couple other groups, and we had Busy Bee's first record was not on MCA, was actually, you know, independent on Strong City, was called Suicide.
Yes.
And then, you know, that Suicide record became such a monster that we got approached by MCA, and I thought that, you know, all right, well, you know, Def Jam is with Columbia, and if I get a deal with MCA and Uni, you know, my company is just going to go through the roof. And it was just the opposite, because MCA at that time was the king of R&B music. They had New Edition, they had Guy, they had Patti LaBelle, they had Jody Watley, Stephanie Mills. So MCA, excuse me, MCA didn't care about any hip hop. And then they had, obviously they had Uptown Records with Heavy D and the boys. And that's all they really cared about was Heavy D at that time.
Wow, it's incredible.
So, you know, we struggled with MCA and, you know, we actually sold out, and I left MCA and left the label with Jazzy J and went on to do independent marketing. I started a marketing company and then became vice president and executive vice president of Dallas Austin's company, Rowdy Records. And when I was at Rowdy, I had a chance to work with L.A. Reid and Babyface. And so it was an interesting, you know, time period for me.
Okay. That's what's up. Rocky, before we let you go, usually we ask everybody, not in any particular historical order, your top three MCs, who you think, you know, from your era, any era, your top three.
My top three. How about I give you a top five?
Okay.
Hi. So top five. My number one would be Rakim.
All right.
Okay.
Number two would be Eminem.
Oh, wow.
Number three would be KRS-One. Mm-hmm. Number four would be Grandmaster Melly Mel. Mm-hmm. And number five would be Biggie.
Wow.
Wow. That's quite an interesting top five you have there, sir.
I respect the list, though.
Yes, no yes.
Doubt, because it's yours. That's right.
Exactly. No yep. doubt. So certainly, Rocky, we appreciate you being on the Hip Hop Digest.
No doubt. I appreciate you guys having me.
No doubt. No doubt.
And you know, every time I see something that's on, you know, Twitter or Facebook or whatever with the museum, you know, I'm pushing it out there to people to listen to us, man. Whatever we can do to help, we're going to do.
Well, let them know about our Kickstarter campaign. We're out there actually trying to raise money right now for this virtual museum. So if they go to Kickstarter.com, type in Universal Hip Hop Museum, or just go to the Universal Hip Hop Museum website, which is www.uhhm.org. They can connect to the Kickstarter campaign that we got going on right now.
Okay, that's what's up.
So I will check back in with you a little later, sir.
All right, thank you, E.
I appreciate it.
All right, bye-bye.
Take care.
All right, brother.